It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So glad to have with us in our Des Moines studio, Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm fine. Rachel, alongside you there in the Des Moines studio, Rachel Caulfield, associate professor of political science, also at Drake. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, good to be here.
Ben, she's been promoted. She's a full professor.
Aye, forgive me, Rachel. I think you gave me that note earlier. Somehow things get transferred notes
fine.
To notes. Full professor, Rachel Caulfield of political science at Drake University. Glad to have you both on the program today. As usual, so much to dig into. We invite our listeners also to join us. 1-866-780-9100. I'm going to be spending quite a bit of time talking about the Russia probe, where it's headed, surrounding developments. We'd like to hear your questions about the Russia probe, where it's headed. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We want to go to the Manafort trial in just a moment, specifically because this is day two of the federal trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. But reaction, first of all, to a morning tweet from the president. He had a very busy weekend of tweeting. I think over 30 tweets on one day on the weekend. This morning in a tweet, the president called on Attorney General Jeff Sessions to end the special counsel investigation. Here is his tweet verbatim. This is a terrible situation, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop this rigged witch hunt right now before it continues to stain our country any further. Bob Mueller is totally conflicted, and his 17 angry Democrats that are doing his dirty work are a disgrace to the USA. Now, according to the Washington Post article, Trump's lawyers quickly added to the tweet by the president saying, this is not an order to a member of his cabinet, but merely an opinion. Dennis Goldford, how unusual is it to have such an appeal by a president to the nation's top law enforcement official to end an inquiry directly into the president?
This particular manifestation is extremely unusual, although we can recall that Richard Nixon did raise questions about the Watergate investigation, but that was before social media, before talk radio, cable TV, and that accelerates and inflames all of this. So this is an attempt on the part of the president, once again, to undermine the legitimacy of this investigation, to suggest that any investigation that reaches the conclusion that he might have done something wrong is inherently flawed, biased, partisan, and therefore illegitimate.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday in a tweet, the president agreed with comments made on Monday by his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, that election collusion with a foreign government is not a crime. And once again, the president denied he was working with Russia during the 2016 campaign in his tweet. But let's listen to a couple of excerpts from Rudy Giuliani, the most present lawyer we're seeing, at least before the media, concerning the Russia probe. Here is Rudy Giuliani in an appearance on Fox and Friends Monday morning saying collusion is not a crime.
I've been sitting here looking in the federal code trying to find collusion as a crime.
It's not.
Collusion is not a crime. Everything that's been released so far shows the president to be absolutely innocent. He didn't do anything wrong.
Okay, he repeated this on CNN, speaking with New Day co-anchor Allison Camerota.
Paul Manafort's trial is starting tomorrow.
Right. And he has no information incriminating of the president. I know that for a fact. They can squeeze him. Paul Manafort does not know anything, and nor could it be possible he did. He was with him for 4 months. I was there when Paul Manafort was there. Paul Manafort was a brilliant gatherer of delegates.
Gatherer of delegates. He was the chairman of the
He was, but he really wasn't. Jared and the sons and Bossy and these other people were really running it. But Paul is a...
saying that Paul Manafort did not have any power in the campaign?
I'm not saying that. I said he had a very discreet, important area. What I'm saying is he was never involved in intimate business relationships with Donald Trump. I mean, that's just 4 months. They're not going to be colluding about Russians, which I'm not even know if that's a crime, colluding about Russians.
Okay.
you start analyzing the crime. The hacking is the crime.
That certainly is the original crime.
Well, the president didn't hack.
Of course not. That's the original
He didn't pay them for hacking.
And as you know, it has led other places. The meeting with the Russians.
If you got the hacked information from the Russians here at CNN and you played it, Would you be in jeopardy of going to jail? Of course not.
So Giuliani has since clarified this comment to say that he has always maintained that first there was no collusion, but even if there was, it's not a crime. Rachel, let's go to you this time. this back and forth, Rudy Giuliani, do you see him doing a good service for the president here as his attorney stirring up this again? And talk about collusion, this point, this word.
Well, on this point, he's actually correct. Collusion is, in a legal sense, really only invoked for investigations of monopolistic business practices. So collusion is an imperfect word to describe what it is that the Trump campaign is being investigated for. Conspiracy against the United States, on the other hand, aiding, abetting, working with, cooperating with, having business arrangements with people who are actively hacking and or trying to mess up, for lack of a better term, the American election system. Those are crimes. They are not collusion per se, but right. They are crimes. Mm-hmm. And in terms of Rudy Giuliani's role, I think it really depends on how, you know, what role is it that the president is looking for Rudy Giuliani to play? Is it to muddy the waters, in which case he appears to be doing a very good job? Is it to kind of draw fire away from other things that are going on, in which case he might be doing a good job? Is it to accurately represent the president's position and aid his, you know, any sort of legal investigation? If that's his role, then I would say he's not doing a very good job.
Dennis, what do you think about the role of Rudy Giuliani?
Comic relief. It's just a matter of listening to what fun things he says on any particular day. Look, the president's technique, evidently, perhaps he did this in his business operations, I don't know, but certainly once he became a candidate and has continued as president, his technique has been to throw sand in the eyes of the public. And Giuliani is certainly doing that. He'll say something one day, clarify it a couple of hours later, and then clarify the clarification. And that simply throws sand in the eyes of the public.
So you think this is calculated and not some degree of just shooting from the hip?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, I guess I like to think I'm an essentially rational person, at least that wants to look at things in a rational way. And some things you think, this cannot be possibly the product of any rational person. Maybe that's the ultimate conspiracy, to be able to appear to be totally irrational and let people think that, no, there is some secret plan there. That's the conspiratorial mindset, basically. But I think that Giuliani doesn't really serve the president well. I mean, look how we've moved from all those sound bites when we have the president say there was no collusion, no collusion, no collusion. Now Giuliani's moved us to, well, collusion is not a crime. Okay, I didn't do it, I didn't do it, but even if I did it, it wasn't a crime. And that shifts the position somewhat that suggests a certain vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the day two of the federal trial of the former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. In its second day, an active first day, Manafort's trial is on bank and tax fraud charges, many charges. Now, this is the first trial to stem from the special counsel, Robert Mueller's investigation, the one that the president said should stop immediately, that the president said is just led by 17 angry Democrats doing the dirty work of Robert Mueller, an investigation into Russian interference. So there are two facets here. We have to remind ourselves, right, and make sure I get these right. Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible looking at cooperation between the Trump campaign and Russia on this. Now, those are the two points, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So in his opening statement yesterday, the government portrayed Manafort as someone who led a lavish lifestyle, and had a disregard for financial law in the U.S. The defense focused on Rick Gates. Now, this was the former right-hand man of Manafort. They worked closely together for years, including going back to Ukraine. They were indicted by the same time by Mueller. Gates pleaded guilty in February. He's been cooperating with the special counsel's office. Dennis, how do you see that the first day from what we've gleaned from the start of the Manafort trial, which will last over the next few weeks? How significant is this trial to the overall Russia probe?
Well, remember, the Russia probe instructions, if I recall, allow the special counsel to pursue any kinds of leads that might grow out of an investigation of the particular question of Russian interference in the 2016 elections. Now, Manafort was the well-regarded by the president himself as a candidate, campaign manager, at least for a short time, of the Trump campaign. He allegedly has had all sorts of business ties with various Ukrainian and Russian interests, so there's some connection there, at least the prosecution is asserting. And whether or not that ties directly to the president, and evidently yesterday there's been no, I don't think they uttered the word Trump in that particular introduction. Basically, Mr. Manafort allegedly had his own private kind of interest, business interest in dealing with these folks. This has popped up now on a special prosecutor's radar, and there have been allegations and charges, of course, that he was not forthright in dealing with his tax returns, things like that. So all this, in a sense, pertains directly to Manafort and his own business activities. But of course, the question would be, if he is successfully prosecuted for these things, then you get into the position of is he willing to cut a deal and tell prosecutors what he knows about any other kinds of activities horizontally or above him in the Trump campaign.
Mm-hmm. So the window to cut a deal is after this trial?
Well, so there are two trials. One has already started in Virginia. Another is scheduled to begin in September, and it primarily deals with witness tampering, among other potential crimes. So Manafort is facing all sorts of legal action against him right now, and I would note that other trial is not being led by Robert Mueller's team. So this is kind of the big test for Robert Mueller and his team regarding the evidence that they have seen so far. Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, today's is such a big deal. But I think there are a couple of clues that have already come out of this trial. It's moving very quickly, first of all. So I, you know, originally the judge had said it would take about 3 weeks. There have been some people who, watching the speed with which they're moving forward, are now saying they could envision it being done in 2 weeks. So it's going to go quickly. And there's, you know, there seems to be some evidence just in the first day and a half that this is a pretty strong case. Most notably, this morning, the prosecution announced there's a possibility that Rick Gates will not testify for the prosecution, which would seem to signal that they believe that they have all the evidence they need without Rick Gates taking the stand. Paul Manafort, meanwhile, you know, that might screw up his defense strategy of really pinning this all on Rick Gates, mm-hmm. and getting him on the stand and questioning him. So, you know, there's kind of a tangled web here. The judge has seemed to agree that at least for the cases of this, for the case of this immediate trial, that Manafort's role in the Trump campaign is not at issue.
Mm-hmm. I would add that there's a real risk here for the Mueller operation, mm-hmm. which is that if they get a conviction from Manafort or a plea before the whole thing ends, that will serve to establish or reinforce the idea that what he's doing is in fact legitimate. If he fails to get a conviction, the president's supporters will jump all over that and say, see, this is a witch hunt. This isn't really legitimate. So Mueller's got to have his ducks in a row for not just this particular trial, but for the whole investigation that's been conducted.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I would speak, you know, on that point, I think that's absolutely true. The fact that they're starting with Manafort, I think, also demonstrates they believe they have a really strong case here.
Right. So interesting that we have, charges that really don't mention Trump at all, but a linchpin for the rest of the Russia probe. You believe, too, as Dennis just said, there'd be what would be the pressure? Where would it come from if there is an acquittal in this case, Rachel?
Well, if there's an acquittal in this case, then it really does reinforce that Robert Mueller's team is barking up a lot of trees without a lot of evidence. And so the president's allies, I think, at that point would come out very forcefully and say, look, the president's been right about this all along. Robert Mueller's on this weird little fishing hunt, fishing trip, and he's not coming up with anything. Let's end this thing and let's move on. And they would have a lot more legitimacy and credibility in saying it.
Mm-hmm. Rachel Caulfield is with us of Drake University, if you've just joined us. Also of Drake, Dennis Goldford, our political scientist on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's talk about the news of Facebook this week pertaining to the Russia investigation. Adjunct to it, is Russia again attempting to interfere in our elections? Well, Facebook says it will leave that determination to law enforcement. They're currently investigating the activity. Here's what Facebook says it has deleted: a covert campaign to influence our November midterm elections by targeting hot-button social issues. 32 fake pages and accounts created between March of 2017 and May of 2018 that were discovered a couple weeks ago. They've been removed, says Facebook. This comes after warnings we've heard in our news from intelligence and law enforcement officials that Russia would engage in election interference in this year's elections, just as it did, as confirmed by all of our intelligence agencies in the 2016 presidential election. Dennis, what do you make of this? What questions does it raise when you see Facebook being much more active than before 2016, but still we are under siege again, it seems?
It appears to be the case. I mean, historically, in one sense, I keep thinking of those things we learned about in high school history, the XYZ affair, the attempt on the part of France in the late 1790s to have an influence in American politics. And the president, although he said it inartfully at times, is not wrong when he said the U.S. has attempted to influence elections in other people. But again, I just can't emphasize the extent to which the internet and social media are accelerants for all these sorts of things. They make it so much easier to do. They make things so much more all-pervasive. And just the danger is to our form of government is that people fundamentally have to trust each other. Mm-hmm. And things like this on Facebook, as well as all sorts of demagoguery that we get from politicians and other folks, that helps to undermine the trust that we need to have if democracy is going to have a chance of working.
Rachel, talk a little bit more about what you know about what these fake pages were intending to do, just as in 2016. These are not pushing this latest batch that were removed by Facebook, not pushing specific candidates, right? Just trying to stir up what? Chaos and the extremes?
And distrust. So there are kind of multiple things that people have pointed to right now. On Facebook specifically, these seem to be issue-based campaigns that are really focused on exploiting divisions within American society. So, for example, one of them was, I believe, called the Resistors. They've organized a series of events, I think 17 events in total across all these different groups. There's a mindfulness group that apparently Facebook believes might be linked to the same operation. There's a group called Black Elevation. The idea is that they're really trying to exacerbate existing divisions within American society, particularly around identity politics. And there has been some supposition out there that Donald Trump one side says, look, he's aware of the fact that Russia may intervene to help Democrats in this election, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. But there's another group that's saying, look, Donald Trump himself might like it if the Democrats did really well in the 2018 midterm elections, because it would give him a foil, some opposition to campaign against going into his 2020 reelection campaign. So it's difficult to know exactly from a social or electoral perspective, is Russia still trying to help Donald Trump? Is that claim still on the table? Or is Russia simply trying to disrupt and sow discord among the American voting electorate?
Mm-hmm. A couple minutes before we have to go to break, let's quickly get in a caller. Troy is with us from Iowa City. Not much time, Troy. What do you have to chip in?
Yes, but my question is do you really think 35 people can swing an election? And isn't there like Mexican nationals that have Facebook pages that are posting in the United States? Wouldn't that swing the election more than 35 Russians?
Okay.
So we'll just say several hundred or thousands of Mexican nationals that are in the United States or that are actually active in swinging the election toward the Democrats.
Okay, Troy, let's get reaction to your question quickly before we go to break. Who wants to tackle that, Rachel or Dennis?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things about Facebook, of course, anybody can have a page on Facebook, right? So I'm sure we have, you know, Mexican nationals in the United States as well as outside the United States, as well as Turkish nationals and Egyptian nationals. And right, I mean, there's a wide range of people on Facebook. I think what distinguishes this particular set of pages that Facebook would point to is that this is a coordinated effort through the government, that it's sponsored by the Russian government, and that it comes together into some sort of coherent strategy to disrupt American elections. Now, you know, the degree to which that's true, that's what people are trying to figure out at this point. What sort of influence did they have in 16? What sort of influence could they have in 2018 or 2020? And, you know, just to play contrarian for a minute, I have a little bit of concern only in the sense that people post a lot of things on Facebook. The fact that American voters seem to be so reliant on Facebook for their news, I find very troubling in the first place. So I think we have to take some responsibility here as consumers of news to recognize that we need to validate our sources and we need to seek a diverse source of our information.
And the point that Troy made about, 35 people, I don't know exactly what that was a reference to, but in our internet age, our digital age, one person, Donald Trump, has over 30 or 40 million followers on Twitter, right? So
right.
One person can make these ripples. In this case, on Facebook, more than 290,000 Facebook accounts were following the fake pages that were just taken down by Facebook. As you mentioned, Mindful Being, Resistors, Black Elevation, and so forth. So we have to get used to the fact that we're in a new age and that, throwing a pond in the stone in the pond can have ripples far in excess of what they did in previous generations. Would that be an image you could buy, Rachel?
Yes, absolutely.
We'll be back in just a moment. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Dennis Goldford, also of Drake University. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about some hearings they've been having about the family separation, the zero tolerance policy toward illegal immigration. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, I'll talk with media and public affairs scholar David Karp of George Washington University. He'll tell us about a number of communication trends he's seeing in this midterm election campaign. Also tomorrow on the program, a conversation with Deidre DeGier. She's the Democratic candidate facing Paul Pate for Iowa Secretary of State. Interesting. She is the first African-American candidate to be nominated in a major political party for statewide office here in Iowa. Tomorrow on the program, a conversation with Deidre DeGier. Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, Rachel Caulfield of Drake University of the Political Science Department there, lending us their insights what we're seeing on our political landscape in the first half hour, talking a lot about the Russia probe and related news items. Wanted to switch and talk a little bit about the aftermath of the zero tolerance policy from early May until that process was stopped last month. 2,500 children separated from their parents as part of this administration's zero tolerance policy toward illegal immigration. Many of these people had crossed the U.S.-Mexican border illegally. Others were seeking asylum. Now, the Trump administration facing a lot of criticism for separating migrant families at the border, detaining immigrant children. High-ranking officials from five different agencies were involved in family separation were called to testify before a Senate Judiciary Committee. That was yesterday. And let's hear a little bit of that testimony about the policy of family separation. This is Immigration Customs Enforcement Executive Associate Director of Enforcement and Removal Operations, Matthew Albence, comparing family detention centers to summer camp.
We have officers in these facilities on a daily basis. I think the best way to describe them is to be more like a summer camp.
Now, Iowa Republican Senator Charles Grassley chairs the Judiciary Committee. Hundreds of children still in custody. We know this because their parents have been deported or released into the U.S. after signing documents agreeing to leave their children behind. Immigrants' rights advocates say many of those parents were coerced into signing documents they didn't understand. Here's what Senator Grassley said about those allegations.
We ought to be disturbed, and I'm disturbed by these allegations.
A lot of testimony there, and I don't know how much each of you followed. Rachel, what do you think of this aftermath? We have several hundred children still not, what is it? The Trump administration says 463 migrant parents may have been deported without children. What do you make of this aftermath?
Well, this is going to be an ongoing, I think, effort to understand exactly how the decision was made, how a series of decisions were made, and what the long-term effects will be for the families and for the children. This, like a lot of other Trump administration policies, seems to have been put in place in, let's say, a haphazard manner. So there were all different agencies who seemed to be at the table kind of talking about it, but nobody seems to know exactly how the final decision-making process happened. So, for example, one of the HHS officials who was talking to Congress said, look, I raised concerns about the psychological harm that could be done as a result of separating children from families. And ultimately, I was told that this is the law. So we have to do it. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of accountability at this point. As we go through this process of learning more about the decision making, whether or not that accountability is going to become more clear is something that I think we have to keep looking mm-hmm. for.
I wonder, Dennis, if you think this family separation controversy has shaped the larger debate over immigration policy going on for many years in this country.
At this point, I'm not sure that it has. I mean, it seems, first of all, as we know, that we had a certain period in June, early July, when that was the dominant story across all networks, channels, frequencies, and so forth. And then, you know, something else happens, and that knocks that out of the headlines, whether broadcast or print, and something else takes its place. So there's still a lot going on, but it's sort of the second tier of stories, the B block, or just not the dominant story at the moment. I mean, right now, look, it's all the Manafort trial, for
right.
example. But I think, what struck me was early on, and I think it was Attorney General Sessions. It was either he or someone of that stature. If I read this and understood it right, it seemed like basically initially a kind of threat. Hey, you try to enter illegally, you risk having your children taken away from you.
Right.
And then, you know, that was seen as a deterrent. And then they pulled back from that somewhat in word, if not deed, by thinking, well, this has just gone way beyond what people are willing to stomach. It struck people as Sophie's Choice or things that really unsavory regimes did. But it's just an ongoing problem. I think that, the president's, some commentator said a month or so ago, Donald Trump is not president of the United States. He's president of his base. And we saw him where in Florida, in Tampa, I think last night. Anytime he seems to feel particularly threatened, he wants to go out and stand before the Fifth Avenue Republicans. You know, if I can shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose a single vote, because they're his security blanket. They're who the Ryans and McConnells and such in Congress are afraid of. And so he needs to keep that particular base energized. And one of the key concerns they've had is this issue of immigration. So between the wall and talking about getting tough on illegal immigrants, that serves his sense of security, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a little bit of audio from that Tampa, Florida rally that the president held yesterday. This was an interesting cut, received a lot of press. Donald Trump arguing for tougher voter ID checks. Of course, that's been the talk for a long time here in the state of Iowa as well with our new voter ID law. But here, the president... the president is saying that we have to present photo IDs at supermarkets. Let's listen to his comments yesterday from a Tampa, Florida rally.
We believe that only American citizens should vote in American elections. Which is why the time has come for voter ID, like everything else. Voter ID. You know, if you go out and you want to buy groceries, you need a picture on a card. You need ID. You go out and you want to buy anything, you need ID and you need your picture. In this country, the only time you don't need it, in many cases, is when you want to vote for a president, when you want to vote for a senator, when you want to vote for a governor or a congressman. It's crazy.
So, Rachel, what do you think of having to whip out your photo ID when you want to buy a hamburger or lettuce?
I don't have to do that. So
I guess
maybe
I don't
I'm
either.
One of the lucky few. I don't know.
I'm going to start asking you for ID every
time
really? I see you.
Just check.
What's your reaction to this comment?
Well, it was interesting. Right after it happened, some commentator last night said, you know, he was talking about voter ID and then it got weird. this is one of those moments where you're reminded of exactly how out of touch people can be with the everyday operations of our lives, right? That normal everyday people go through. I understand that he's trying to make a point. Maybe he hasn't really shopped at a grocery store since people use checks and had to show ID for checks. I don't know. It's a very odd claim. And I think it illustrates the degree to which he says he's right there with the everyday, common, normal, quote-unquote, American, but is actually pretty out of tune with how we live our lives.
I'm reminded, I'm pretty sure it was...
I know exactly what you're going to say right now.
92, not 88, yeah. But George H.W. Bush
yes.
happened
yep.
to end up in a grocery store, and he was mystified by a scanner.
Yep.
He had no idea what a scanner was in a grocery, that you just pass your products over and the computer recognizes and charges the right price. And that was taken to be a sign, or at least a symbol, of the idea that he was so out of touch with the lives of ordinary Americans. As Rachel said, I don't really... I can't imagine Donald Trump stopping off at a Quick Trip for a big gulp, or if I've mixed my my products, I don't know. But I don't know that he's done that. But I think at the root of all that, I keep having this image in my head of a town hall meeting, I think in April of 2009, so President Obama hadn't had his 100 days yet. And there was an elderly woman quaking with anger and fear saying, "I want my country back." And this sense of fear of being bypassed by all these new social groups and religions and races and social forces and economic developments. And when the president now talks about voter ID or being an American citizen and all that, you know, make America great again. You know, return us to Ozzie and Harriet in the 1950s, even though for women, minorities, folks like that, the 50s weren't so great. But for good white Protestant Americans, they were pretty decent. They weren't even great for Catholics, you know. So that's that sense of loss on the part of so many Trump supporters is what he appeals to. And it's a very powerful emotion, and he appeals very successfully to it.
Finishing up Politics Wednesday with Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. I wanted to ask you about the apparent feud between President Trump and the Koch brothers. Charles Koch, one of the Republicans' biggest donors, has been critical of the president, specifically of his protectionist trade policies. Donald Trump hitting back Tuesday by attacking Charles Koch along with his brother, David, naming the powerful political network they founded as, in his words, totally overrated, a total joke in real Republican circles, tweeting, "I never sought their support because I don't need their money or bad ideas. Let's listen to what the president was reacting to in that excerpts from his tweets. The Koch network has split with the Trump administration on tariffs and trade policy. Their Koch network released a video featuring Charles Koch condemning protectionism. Here are a few seconds of that.
In response, we're seeing a rise in protectionism, where countries, organizations, and individuals are trying to protect themselves from these changes. They're doing whatever they can to close themselves off from the new, hold onto the past, and prevent change. This is a natural tendency, but it's a destructive one. Because when people act in protectionist ways, they erect barriers, which makes everyone worse off. The urge to protect ourselves from change has doomed many countries throughout history. And this protectionist mindset has destroyed countless businesses as well.
Rachel, what does this rift between the Koch brothers and the president represent?
Well, I think it, you know, there's been this, and it's happening in both parties, I think. There's been this quest to define the ideologies of both the Democratic and Republican parties over the past couple election cycles. And the Kochs have emerged as a really significant voice for the mainstream business anti-taxation wing of the Republican Party. And they've tended to play pretty well with the Republicans. But Donald Trump is not their kind of Republican. And they're not alone in that. I mean, if you go, you don't have to go back far, right? But if you go back to the convention, you remember this huge Never Trump movement within the Republican Party. So you have factions within the Republican Party who have never signed on to the support of Donald Trump. And then you have kind of other Republicans, particularly those in government, who for various reasons have said, okay, you know what? We may not be on board with everything that Donald Trump stands for, but we're going to get a lot of policies here that we really like. And so we're willing to form kind of a coalitional, relationship with the president in order to advance our policy goals. The Kochs are not there. They're upset about this particular trade policy and the series of trade policy actions by the president. And they have the clout in the Republican Party. They're pretty accustomed to being able to shape the message and the policy of the Republican Party. And so they have positioned themselves. Donald Trump does not like it when particularly Republicans disagree with him and do so publicly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's and I would just add, I think in his mind, it allows him to separate himself from this mainstream institutional Republican Party that he has equated with, you know, the swamp. So the moneyed interests that he can break away from and represent something different.
Dennis, will this feud with the Koch brothers impact the midterms at all that you can see?
Well, that remains to be seen. We have the Heidi Heitkamp and Kramer race. Was it North Dakota? And they've said they won't really give Kramer any money. Heitkamp isn't saying she's going to adopt. She's a Democrat. She's not going to adopt Koch principles or anything like that. But they have a lot of money. I mean, their organization, their roundtable, and of course, their political arm is Americans for Prosperity, which has functioned almost as its own kind of unofficial political party. And I believe they ran candidates in Iowa City for city council a couple of years ago. I mean, they are active in Iowa. That's another issue, what's happening with our political parties when these independent groups function as quasi-parties. But I think you have to commit to donate $100,000 a year to this operation. And they have, I've seen figures from 500 to 700 members willing to do that. That's a big piece of change. And they've committed, at least $250 million, maybe up to $400 million for the midterms this year. But in this sense, they're acting more like an interest group than as a political party. The interest group is concerned principally with policy. They're concerned less with personnel. So if you advocate my interests, I don't care which party you are, Whereas a political party says, at least in the past, no, I want my person there. We'll work on our disagreements about issues. And so, however, I'll leave it to others to talk about the connection between the Koch's political principles and their business interests. But remember, one of them, and I can't remember which one, ran as the Libertarian Party candidate for president about 30 or 40 years ago. And this is more of a libertarian notion of free trade and no tariffs, things like that. And that's been the Paul Ryan and general Republican approach. But Trump has found this this element of people feeling left behind, particularly in Appalachian areas and certain southern areas that where the factories have closed and manufacturing has decreased. And free trade, in their view, doesn't serve their interests, which is why Trump was appealing to them.
Mm-hmm. In the few moments we have remaining, I'd like to get each of your thoughts on how each party looks at this point going into the midterms. This week we passed through the 100-day before the November election mark. Rachel, what do you see? How are the Democrats? Take the Democrats. How are they set up to win back at least one House of Congress?
Well, you know, when Trump first came into office, I think there was a ton of excitement among Democrats for this quote-unquote blue wave. And we kept hearing about the blue wave election of 2018 and you know, massive wins in the House of Representatives, high likelihood of taking over the U.S. Senate. I think most Democrats have tempered their expectations for 2018. The Democrats, like the Republicans, and the Republicans started earlier, but the Democrats are certainly there now. There's really a tug of war within the party to determine what kinds of policies and candidates they're going to put forward and how they're all going to play together and play together well. There's no doubt that there's enthusiasm among Democrats for this midterm race, and I expect that they'll do pretty well. But the party that doesn't control the presidency always does well in midterm elections. That's just historically true.
The achievable...
I don't think this is going to be an unprecedented win for the Democrats.
Okay, the achievable fruit, if we can put it that way, that people are talking about is those 23 flips in the House to make it. Dennis, to you, do you think that looks achievable or likely, perhaps a better question at this point?
Well, you know, I feel great today, but I could get hit by a bus tomorrow. So you never know what's going to happen in this regard. And yes, as Rachel said, she's quite right. The Democrats have exhibited a certain greater than normal enthusiasm and participation in primaries thus far this spring and some special elections. And yes, the party in power that controls the presidency usually loses some seats, although not in 2002 with Bush, not in 1998 with Clinton. I have my umbrella, but I'm not confident that I'm going to need it against the tsunami at this point. Republicans continue to take voting much more seriously, even in midterms, than Democrats do. And Democrats and independents especially tend not to turn out very much for a midterm election. A midterm electorate has much more of a Republican tilt than the electorate in the presidential year. So, yeah, if the election were held yesterday, Tuesday, Democrats probably would have done pretty well. We still have over 90 days to go.
All right. Are you each of you paying much attention to polling? What polls, if you are?
Well, you know, I look at the generic ballot every so often, but, you know, you really have to go state by state here. These are very individualized races, particularly House races, where you're looking at districts that are very, very different from each other. And one of the things that I think some big Democratic operatives have figured out, and we're seeing this in special elections in particular, is that you choose the candidate for the district, not for the national ideology. And so, you know, they're very idiosyncratic races at this point. I haven't seen a lot of polling in some of those districts.
Okay. We need to leave it there. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University. Dennis Goldford, professor and chair of political science at Drake University. Thank you both so much for joining us this hour, coming into the studio.
Thanks, Ben. Mm-hmm. Good to be here.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Also help today from Shirley Wong. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. A reminder that in the coming weeks leading up to the midterm election, we'll be focusing on each of our congressional races, devoting significant time to it, as well as to the gubernatorial election. So you want to stay tuned for that here on Politics Wednesday. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Remember, tomorrow, conversation with Deirdre Dejere, the Democratic candidate facing Paul Pate for Iowa Secretary of State. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.